Thy best works.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Some days ago, I got a little note that says, "Are some thoughts, thoughts, zazen, and some probably so." It's anonymous. So I thought it'd be okay. I thought it'd be okay to read it.
Once it's too loud.
That's too loud. Okay. Well, today I want to talk about ability and disability.
Ability and disability. Not loud enough.
Ordinarily, when I give zazen instruction, the instruction is the ideal way to practice zazen for a healthy 25-year-old person.
Like you.
So I talked about keeping the back straight and the body position and all this. So we have to remember that zazen is our practice is always practiced under some restriction. If it's not under some restriction, then it's not practice. So no matter how we are, what our abilities are, both physically, mentally, emotionally, our practice is always under some restriction. So for a person who is sitting idealized zazen in full lotus, that is the most restricted way you can possibly practice. You're totally tied without any totally tied in this position without moving. And you have to find your freedom within that restriction. You have to find full total freedom within full total restriction. That's what zazen is about today. No matter what your abilities are, there's always the restriction faces each one of us. So we each practice according to what our physical abilities will allow, and our mental abilities, and our emotional abilities. And those, if you're, for instance, in a wheelchair, the wheelchair determines your posture. And so you have to find your what we call posture, and posture includes whichever way we're, our body is situated. Within that restriction is where you find your practice. When you have a pain in your legs, that's the place where you find your practice. If you can't sit up straight, that's where you find your practice. So we always find our practice where we are. I wrote a list of restrictions. The first restriction, actually, that we all experience is gravity. Gravity is what we are continuously interacting with all the time. We're either standing up, lying down, the four positions of a person: standing, walking, lying, and sitting. In all those positions, it all depends on gravity. We take our postures from gravity. When you're up in a spaceship, you have a different posture. So, it's my physical ability as I deal with posture, with gravity. So it really determines all of our actions. So it's constant and covers everything. If you let go of the dish, so sometimes we need assistance to deal with it. So our I call it our spirit, you know, our buoyancy or our life force is in contrast to gravity. So life force and gravity are the two basic elements that we're dealing with. And when we sit in Zazen, or practice Zazen, those two forces are determining how we do this. So when we say, sit up straight, don't lean left or right, and so forth, we're taking a position, actually the most natural position to deal with gravity. And to free ourselves. Because freedom means freedom within gravity. Either we're victims of gravity, or we have freedom within gravity. So, then we have outer restrictions and inner restrictions. Outer restrictions, gravity. Inner restrictions, our own physical abilities. Like, I can only do so much because I have this problem. So everybody has some problem. So we can't practice without our problem. And so our problem has to be our practice. So Suzuki Roshi says, we should all be very grateful for the problem we have. We may want to change our problem or improve our problem, but if we do, we may find ourselves having a worse problem. Not necessarily, but if you don't have a heart attack, the cancer will get you. So then we have mental restrictions. Mental restrictions can be either, I mean, that's a whole, mental restriction is a whole study in itself. I can, I can't, I don't want to, I do want to, I blah, 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 and so forth. This is why Zazen goes beyond thinking. It's really true. In order to do Zazen, we have to go beyond thinking. We have to go beyond what we think. The way I was brought up to practice Zazen was to encourage myself to go beyond what I thought I could do. So Suzuki Hiroshi was always, in his own individual way, encouraging us always to go beyond what we thought we could do. We come up against a problem and we think, well, this is my limitation. I can't go any farther. And yet, he would always encourage us to go farther than we think our limitations are. And this is, has always been the ground of my practice. And so I have that kind of way, you know, I don't let anything stop me. People say, well, what do you do when you have this problem and that problem? I just go through it. That's my way. But I can't tell other people to do that, because then they'll say, see, I broke my leg and you encouraged me.
You don't tell people to do that?
Break their leg?
No.
Oh, I do.
Cut right through it? Give me...
I do, but I don't insist.
Oh. Or am I the only person in the room?
Anyway. So we tell ourselves all kinds of things. You know, I'm not saying that we shouldn't do that. But this is where practice gets very tricky. You know, because we always have a self-preservation at heart. We really want to take care of ourselves and make sure that we don't, you know, do something wrong. But when I was practicing with Suzuki Roshi, it was like, I'll do this if I have to die on the cushion. As a matter of fact, that's what you do. You die on the cushion. And then you enjoy your life. So, it's very tricky. How to recognize a disability and know just how far to go and just how far to push yourself. And there is a line there or where you have to make those decisions for yourself. those are like mental restrictions, like what should I do, you know, how far should I take this, so, and how do I understand what I'm doing. So then there are emotional restrictions, which are my feelings. Whenever I sit zazen, you know, I get this, you know, a picture of my past and my incest and all these things that come up that are very difficult to deal with when we're sitting and pose a kind of problem emotionally. And how, so that becomes the place where your practice really becomes alive. Not like you figure out what, you know, caused all this and so forth, but you simply stay with that. Stay with your emotional problem without exaggerating it and without making it smaller than what it is, and just letting it be there and realizing that we just go beyond. Now is the time to let go. My parents did it, that's why I'm like this. Maybe so. But there, you have to be able to say, okay, that happened, this is where it is. Now, my life begins from here. So this is how we, you know, sit zazen. My life begins from here. This is the first step of my new life. Every moment. Even though we do have all this stuff in our past and so forth, but the truth is that our life begins from here. And we have that opportunity to let go and just step into the void. You know, I was talking yesterday about practice being established beyond consciousness. Vinkarishi says we should establish our practice beyond consciousness. So consciousness is what holds us in this earthly paradigm. To go beyond consciousness is to live our life moment by moment in the moment without it being conditioned by our past or by anything. This is called freedom. And this is what we mean by freedom from karma. Even though karma is there, we have freedom within the karma. So, then there are feeling restrictions. I feel good, or I feel bad, or I feel this way or that way. But given that restriction of feelings, that's where my practice begins. You know, the four foundations of mindfulness feed to observe, or observe may not be the best term, but to observe the feelings in the feelings. In other words, not observing feelings as objects, but let the feelings be there and observe the feelings in the feelings. Just bear attention. So bear attention is Zazen. With thinking mind, feelings, emotions, just bear attention without judgment and without following something up. It comes as it comes and it goes as it goes. But we have freedom from it, freedom within it. And then, of course, there are the bodily restrictions. Everyone has some disability. Some disabilities are greater than others. And people with really, really difficult physical disabilities who insist on practice and don't complain, but simply practice according to what the disability will allow, are the most inspiring people. And in some sense, we're all like that. We practice within what our abilities will allow. I remember in the old days, back in the 60s, everybody felt like we all had to do exactly the same thing, you know. And so if you were, no matter what your problem was, you just sat through it. But nowadays, more people, as the Sangha grows, and it's not just hippies and, you know, younger people, and our lives change, and our physical abilities become depleted. But still, how do we practice given the restrictions that we have? So I think we really need to understand that. Because sometimes people with disability that is obvious feel that they're seen as not being able to practice like everybody else. And so it causes, you know, whenever we can't come up to the norm, so to speak, we always feel that way. If you're, as soon as you break your leg or you know get restricted in some way, you see the world going by you, and you can't participate in the same way. So we have to be able to open our mind to, if we have a disability, to realize that given your disability, your effort is actually to maintain practice. That instead of being a third-class citizen of the Zendo, your effort is actually inspiring everybody. So what it depends on is your intention and your effort. And doesn't have any. It's not about practicing in the ideal way, but actually, if you are making that effort, and it looks funny, that's the ideal way. So we have, when I give Zazen instruction and I talk about posture and so forth, what each one of us has to do is figure out, well, where am I in that ideal? And how do I match myself up with that ideal when I can't? So, you know, it's like when I was doing a funeral ceremony for Meili, I went to the Japanese priest and I said, what is the ceremony anyway? And so they gave me this big long sheet of stuff, you know, and I thought, well, I can't do that. It's too much. So I said so, and he said, oh yeah, you don't have to worry about that. He said, that's the most formal practice, the most formal funeral ceremony. That, you know, maybe do that for the abbot of Eheiji or something when he dies. Maybe not, you know. What you do is you pick out what works for you. This is the stuff that you can use. And you select what works for you. And then you do the ceremony according to the conditions. It's a small ceremony, you just take a few parts. And if it's a very formal ceremony, you take more parts. So it's kind of like that. It's kind of like, this is the ideal, and where do you fit? Because I think the ideal is important, because it sets a standard. But where are you on the standard? And you have to set your own standard. But this is also tricky, because if you simply say, well, you know, this is my limitation, and that's all I can do, then you may not be exerting enough effort to make you go further than you think you can. So when you really find that that practice pulls something forth from you that is more than you thought you could do, that's inspiring for you. So you have to, this is when we have to have your own discernment. And also, it's good to talk to your teacher about what you think you can do and what you think you can't do. I think that's very important. Then you kind of figure out, you know, what to do. Sometimes someone will come to me and I see they're trying too hard. And I say, you know, take it easy. Don't try to do this. Just do it like this. And it's kind of a nice relief, actually, because if you try too hard, then you get discouraged and maybe hurt yourself. You know, when I was sitting Zazen, we all tried to sit in full lotus. And so we did that, some of us, and I sat full lotus for years and years. It's a great way to sit. Now I'm reduced to sitting in a way that I never wanted to. But that's okay. It's good. It's good for my ego. But some people hurt themselves, you know, trying too hard. Suzuki Roshi always said, just a little bit at a time. Just make progress a little. If you make progress a little bit at a time, that's really good. A little bit of progress. Don't try too hard. Don't strain yourself. Don't, you know. When I give Zazen instruction, I show people all the positions. All, you know, full lotus, half lotus, and so forth. And then I say, you should choose the position that's easiest for you. Because you have, the point is not what position you're sitting in, but how can you sit still for 40 minutes? Choose the position that's easiest for you to sit for 40 minutes. If you're sitting sashin, choose the position that's easiest for you to sit 7 days. It's hard enough just to sit. So you don't need to add something to the difficulty. Just the difficulty that's there is enough. So then there are imaginary restrictions. You know about those, right? I'll go on. And then there are circumstantial restrictions. Circumstantial restrictions are my family, my dog, my wife, my work, my school, my all these other responsibilities that I have. So practice, you know, restriction is how do you find your freedom of practice within all those restrictions? I have to work, I have to be at home, I have to shop, I have to do laundry, I have to blah blah blah. And sit zazen. People sometimes say, well, you know, I've been sitting zazen at home. That's great. But, you know, practice is Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Sangha is practicing together. So this makes it far more difficult to practice as Sangha. But we do it. It's great. Unbelievable sangha, actually. It really is an unbelievable sangha. People, all of you are here, you know, like taking off from work and your family and whatever, you know, to do this practice. Just unbelievable. It gives each of us a problem. But it's a good problem. And so, given those elements, plus Sangha. How do we balance all those elements plus Sangha to make a complete circle without and make it actually work? That's actual practice. So in order to do that, we have to have some restrictions. You can't do that and do other things. I mean, you have to know, well, these are the elements, really, in my life that I can actually do and practice at the same time. So it's hard in this society because we have so much opportunity to do. I think in Dogen's time, people didn't have so much opportunity. he did this, he did that. And to have lay people, or whatever we are, practicing like this is unheard of, actually. So this is a pioneering practice. So I wrote something down called barriers. How to tell the difference between what's true and what's false. So where is the line between what you tell yourself and what's really true? That's it. I think what I meant was it has to do something with what I tell myself is I can do a lot, I can do all these things, but what is true is that maybe I can't, you know. Or this is who I am, but maybe it's not. How do you tell the difference? So that's very interesting place. That's like the koan, like, who am I? But you never know exactly. If you say, like Bodhidharma says, I don't know, that's who he is. That's right, I don't know. But given that, we have our life, and are we telling ourselves, are we fudging our life? Are we telling ourselves something that's not true about ourselves? Or do we really see ourselves as we are? And that's it's a fuzzy line. So that's like the Gendo koan, you know, true or false. And then there's the fear problem, the fear barrier. I can only go so far before I get afraid, before I become frightened. And sometimes, you know, fear is like, it looks like a wall. Fear looks like a stone wall. But actually, sometimes it's just a piece of paper with a painting of a stone wall on it. Mm-hmm. And you just walk through it. I remember when I was a kid and I lived in Hollywood. This was back in the 30s. And they had these... Hollywood was not very developed at that time. A lot of vacant lots. As a kid, we used to play in the vacant lots, throwing dirt clods and baking potatoes and under a campfire and stuff. But there was this, and they had these picture movie lots where they had all the props. And they had this old one. We'd climb over the fence and walk around. They had this ship. You know, a sailing ship, but underneath the sailing ship was all just props, you know, holding this facade of a sailing ship. You can get on the deck, but you look down, it's just the ground. And they had a cowboy town, and it really looked like a cowboy town, except that you just walk up to it, open the door, and there was nothing behind it. So, you know, it's kind of like fear, you know. Mm-hmm. It looks like something is there, but you open the door, you just walk through the, you know, the paper facade. So, but that's something that we're always dealing with. And then anxiety, another restriction. Anxiety means that we're breathing up here. Usually when we have anxiety, our breathing is shallow. And something's going on down here that's not calm. So this is, if we really practice Zazen, fear and anxiety become either diminished or are not present. Although I don't, you may experience those in Zazen. But the Zazen gives us the opportunity to calm our mind. So there's, you know, fear of letting go and lack of understanding. I think fear of letting go is a big one. That's a restriction we put on ourselves. It's very we have we have fear of living and fear of dying. It's like the old song, you know, which I'm not going to sing for you. Tired of living and fear of dying. That's what we are. Zazen is kind of like letting go. It's practice in letting go, actually. And all the people that I have, all the practitioners, long time practitioners, that have died, that I have, whose deaths I have attended, it was obvious that their practice helped them to let go. Very obvious that their practice helped them to let go. So, you know, I always felt that I didn't want to sit in a chair, even though I felt it's fine to sit in a chair when you, but I didn't want to do that. But there were several times when I found that I couldn't, because my back would give me a big problem. I had some spasm of a back in my back. So I took one of those chairs that doesn't have legs, that sit on the ground, and I put that up on the tan, just the tassara, and I sat in that chair for zazen on top of the tan, kind of like this, and that was fine. So sometimes we feel that we're kind of proud of our abilities, and then when we have to accommodate to some disability to be able to do that easily and let go of our pride. So I think we have to be careful about pride, and which brings up the don't compare yourself to anybody else. So this is one of a big problem, comparing ourselves to others. Each one of us has our own practice according to our physical, mental, emotional, and situational situation. And it looks like somebody will say, you know, so-and-so, they sit so still, you know, and I'm always wiggling around. And it looks to them like people are watching them wiggle. But actually, you look at them and they're just sitting still. And the person that they're looking at, who looks like they're sitting so still, says, you know, I'm always wiggling around. So, you know, it looks like the person is sitting in the full lotus, up straight, and so is, you know, the king of the roost. But actually, that doesn't mean anything. What is meaningful is what your practice is. It could be that the person who's sitting in the full lotus doesn't have any problems, you know, just calm and no pain. That person's practice is not probably not as meaningful as the practice of someone else who is totally struggling all the time and looks like they can never make it. But that's great practice. The best practice, if you want to differentiate. The person that has the most difficult time, usually, if they stay with the practice, it has the most benefit. And, you know, beginner's practice, someone who just comes into the Zendo and is trying really hard because they don't know what it's about. They're just the blind leading the blind. You know, just because they don't know anything, their practice is really inspiring. I always really like it when new people come and they're trying really hard, they don't know anything, and they're really trying, and that's totally inspiring. That's like reaching for your pillow in the night and you don't know where it is. And so we have to be careful not to judge and not to compare. Not to compare. But we do it anyway. We can't help comparing. But even though you can't help comparing, don't compare. You're doing your practice as you. That person's doing their practice as them. They have all the stuff they have, you have all the stuff that you have. And you may not want all the stuff they have, Mr. Jones. So I know it's time to stop, but if you have a question.
There's a fear that I've been thinking about that there's been an issue at Clearwater, and it's, I'll just give you an example, at the end of service, people freeze. Mm-hmm. They don't put their cushions away and so on. It's like they're waiting for somebody to say, and now put your cushions back the way they were, and then bow to and away from, you know, and they know, they've been told a million times and they've done it a million times and they know what to do. But if somebody doesn't kind of start, they won't do it. And I asked about it once at the, you know, at after service at the beginning of classes, but, you know, what could I do? And I asked about what's it about, and one woman said, really, from her heart, she said, I'm afraid of being wrong. And I think we're really afraid of being wrong, of making a visible mistake. But that's a great fear in practice a lot of times.
Yes, people fear making a mistake. Yeah, that's true. We do. Because the practice looks like so formal, right? And if in Japan, you know, if you were in the monastery, somebody would just come over and hit you, and then you wouldn't make mistakes anymore. But in your case, you know, what I would have done in your case, I would have just stood there and not done a service, not done anything, and just let everybody just stand there.
And I'll do that next time.
What's going on? Try that.
I will.
Peter.
It sounded like when you were talking about mental restrictions, which in my, when you talked about mental restrictions.
Meditation, yeah.
In my mind, that all started to get a little mushy with some of the other, you know, self-imposed restrictions and imaginary restrictions. But is it something like confusion as a restriction?
Well,
should
yeah.
I do this? Should I do that? Blah blah blah. Is this really happening, or is this what I am? Or, you know.
Confusion restricts us.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so I was looking in that category of restriction. Where is the edge where you're really working with practice? I didn't really hear that. And to me, for myself, it's about this kind of confusion.
Right.
And
oh, I see. Yeah. Like, should we do it this way or that way? Or
yeah.
Yeah. Well.
And being able to be with that, and not try and settle it or make it go away.
That's right. Yes. So the way to settle it is to make everybody do the same thing.
What's that?
Make everybody do the same thing. So, right. So, the formal practice is everybody does the same thing, right? And then there are the variations. It's like when we say, when you come to Sesshin, the 3 days or whatever it is. And then, but we don't say, but if you want to, you can come for 2 days. We don't say that. We say 3 days, you know. But then somebody says, well, you know, I can only blah, blah, blah. Okay. So there's the exception, which is built in, but not broadcast. Because if it's so tight that you just have the restrictions and their formality, you reduce your sangha to very small. Because given the nature of this sangha, where everyone has responsibilities outside of this particular form, we always have to make accommodations. So sometimes it looks like things are kind of loose and, you know, but that may not be what you're talking about exactly. But that's an example that I'm talking about.
You want me to ask you?
Yeah.
Again, what I was trying to get clarified about was what is really the nature of the mental restriction. I was trying to suggest that perhaps it was a kind of confusion, and that how to practice with that is to allow yourself to be confused, even though it's kind of distressing, to admit to one's own confusion.
Oh, yes, yeah. Yeah, well, you know, admitting it to yourself is part of practice, definitely. Whatever, you know, confusion, yeah. I think, and it's good to express your confusion. If you don't express it, then you might get discouraged and leave because you don't think there's any venue, you know, or the people won't accept you or whatever.
You just make a mistake.
Just well, making mistakes is really good. That's the thing. You know, there's the form and then there's the mistake. And the mistake is what we appreciate. We appreciate the mistake. You know, clatter, clatter, clatter. You know. Shut up. Just to let ourselves know that we made the mistake is good. Like, I thought I was doing pretty well this time. I know that you know that you're making mistakes. I've been very gentle. You know, we have to be careful that we're not trying to be perfect. We're not trying to be perfect. We're just trying to do the practice. And the practice has its way of there's a way to practice. There's a formal way to practice that helps us work together. And so the problem with formality is it looks like you're trying to be perfect. But we're not trying to be perfect. Whatever we do is perfect. As long as we're making the effort to stay within the parameters of the formal practice. So mistakes are, you know, we shouldn't get angry about mistakes. And we shouldn't get angry about being corrected. A correction simply means when something's leaning over, it should be upright, you know. And so you say, oh, look, it's laying down. Oh, okay, I turned it upright. Oh, I'm so bad because I was laying down and now I'm up again. You don't say that verbally, but it goes on inside. So correction is not the same as blame, but we think of correction often as blame, not just correction. So every time I come up to the altar, the water bowl is off to the right. The water. It's always off to the right. 99% of the time. And I look at it and I say, well, I take it and I put it, line it up. I don't know why it's always off to the right. Maybe it's where I'm standing. I'm standing in the center, believe me. So anyway, this is you know, why, how do I deal with what I think it should be this way, but it's not. And that goes for almost everything we do. So how do I stand that? No blame. My practice is no blame.
For me, I find that I'm much more critical and much more blaming when I'm personally feeling basically frustrated.
Yes.
But when I'm not feeling basically frustrated with my life, I find that I notice that I put much less spin on things. I might still see a lot of mistakes and I'll correct myself and correct other people, but I just, you know, it's like when I'm coming from a frustrated place, then it puts a spin on everything.
Yeah, that's right.
And when I'm not, then I just notice it's so different sometimes.
Yes, so don't get frustrated. In other words, how do you find your freedom within frustration? That's the practice. It's not that you don't get frustrated. You get frustrated all the time. But how do you free yourself from the frustration without pretending it's not there? That's our natural call. And we work with it all the time. Life is frustrating.